Bom, eu estou aqui só para umas palavras rápidas. O meu nome é Manuel Henrique, eu estou a representar a Trienal e queria dizer-vos algumas palavras. Bem, além de dizer que estamos muito contentes com esta quarta edição de Human Entities e de receber aqui o Escada e hoje especialmente a Margarida, mas as minhas palavras são mais práticas. A casa de banho é ali, onde tem aqueles pictogramas. A saída vai ser apenas por ali, aquela porta que está iluminada. Se alguém quiser sair a meio, pode sair. Peço só que feche a porta quando sair, portanto, não a deixe aberta, portanto, esta porta dá acesso a um espaço que tem uma porta para a rua. O espaço para onde vocês entraram vai estar fechado, porque a exposição fecha agora às 19. Queria pedir-vos para manterem as cadeiras no lugar, portanto, não as deslocarem. E para manterem a máscara, exceto quando estiverem a dar um gol no chá. Obrigado.
Olá, boa tarde. Vou passar para inglês, porque este é um evento internacional. Peço desculpa. Welcome to the second session of the fourth edition of Human Entities. Thank you so much for coming out and experimenting how we can still be together. Human Entities is a series of public talks focused on technological change and its impacts, the ways culture and technology shape and influence each other. We are CADA, I'm Sofia Oliveira, this is Jared Hockey, and as organizers of this event, we must thank the DG Arch for its financial support. CADA would also like to thank our amazing partner, the Lisbon Architecture Triennale, for hosting and promoting the event. And we're also especially grateful to our supporters, Lisbon City Council, Professor Nuno Correia at Nova Links, Universidade Nova de Lisboa, and Assistant Professor Alexandra Paio of the Department of Architecture and Urbanism at ISCTE, IUL. And finally, also want to thank Chloe Gastin, who works with CADA and collaborated in the research for this year's edition. And finally, thank you, Margarida, for accepting our invite.
Margarida Menz's research explores the overlap between cybernetics, ecology, and experimental film, investigating environmental transformations and their impact on societal structures and cultural production. She's interested in exploring alternative modes of education and political resilience through her collaborative practice, curatorial work, and activism. Recently, she was part of the curatorial team of the 11th Liverpool Biennale, which has been rescheduled for 2021. And in 2019, she launched Plant Revolution, an exhibition series which explores encounters between species alongside different narratives of technological mediation. For us, much of her work appears to be driven by a deep curiosity about the unseen. This may be taken to mean both the highly complex and abstract, and also what is literally invisible or out of sight. It might also mean what, due to its extreme everydayness, has receded into the background, what, despite being integral to daily social life, is often ignored. When talking to her, she zooms in and out of subject areas, switching between different scales and crossing with ease different fields of knowledge. Apparently, for Margarida, scales and frames of reference are as much about what they reveal as what they hide. Welcome, Margarida.
Thank you, Jared and Sophia. I'm a little shy after the introduction. Thank you, everybody, for bearing with the cold. There's enough tea and blankets for all. And for being here today is an act of resistance to stay together, I think. And I'm humbled to speak in front of this tree that has much more knowledge than I do. And really grateful to be here in Triennale. So I'm sharing some work in progress, and English is clearly not my first language, so apologies for any vortexes. Hopefully we can talk more about it later. So, Thinking along river systems, how can we understand the continuity between bodies and the environment? Can sound be used as a medium to expand our perceptions of toxicity while raising awareness to other forms of sensing? On this brief presentation of research in progress, I will introduce my reflections on sound as a tool for ecological literacy, departing from a study of aquatic ecosystems exposed to extractive economies, particularly in the lower Mississippi River and Tejo River estuary. I will introduce thoughts around ecological conservation, water politics, and the kinetics of toxicity, while challenging fixed conceptions of the bodily and partitioned views of the environment. I propose that we expand our understanding of hydrosystems, following elemental pathways in the lines of Chinese medicine concept of qi, which corresponds to vital energy, running across scales connecting bodies and the environment transgenerationally. Reflecting about the interwoven continuity between bodies and ecosystems, I propose to mobilize the concept of the infrastructural body, thinking about elemental, energetic, and vibrational relations on an interscalar manner, and the role of different sensing regimes in this equation. What does it mean to practice? No. Sorry, last minute edit. What kind of practices of sensing and attunement can listen to other than human entities? A prehistory of flux. In ancient Greece, it was thought that the earth exhaled under the influence of the sun, which fed the growth on the earth's surface and of other celestial bodies that surrounded it. In the 15th century, the liquid seed theory was thought to explain the origin of matter, describing the earth as a fertile womb where seeds of stones, metals, minerals would grow, fermenting mineral juices in ungrounding veins, which eventually sprout precious metals such as gold and silver. This uterine tectonic activity was destabilized by the extractive hand of humans who probed the reproductive insides of the planet searching for resources, leading to the Earth's tremors. It was imagined that the desecration of terrestrial secrets in gestation would lead to the Earth's swallowing of those who dare to plunder its veins and mineral resources, suffocating miners in its inner vapors. To our amazement, this allegory is not so far from the truth, as in this world under permanent drilling, the ongoing extraction of hydrocarbons and the marked presence of fracking in the Canadian state of Alberta since 1953 has led to some 2,800 recorded earthquakes in the last three decades due to more than 17,000 boreholes that have been opened. So I want to start by giving you the concept of infrastructure defined by the U.S. President's Commission on Critical Infrastructure as, quote, a network of independent, mostly privately owned man-made systems and processes that function collaboratively and synergistically to produce and distribute a continuous flow of essential goods and services, end of quote. This definition, which is expanded by Paul N. Edwards, he describes it as a social-technical infrastructure comprising all technological systems that support society, including computer networks and weather forecasting, as well as transport, water networks, and buildings. And in the case of transportation systems of electric power, create what appear on the human scale as amplifications of natural energies beyond what unaided human beings or animals could achieve. So I will focus my presentation on aquatic infrastructures. That's my point of departure for my PhD research, which comprise not only technological spaces, but also a hybrid mix of both natural and man-made items of various scales. Aquatic infrastructures are often points in the intertidal zone, that is a contact zone between where land and water meet, as well as different species and communities. So these areas are usually referred to as ecotones, regions of transition between two biological communities, and often richer in biodiversity where evolutionary pathways cross and co-evolve. I want to keep in mind the concept of infrastructure throughout this talk, questioning our conception of the body in corporate territory, proposing what I name as the infrastructural body, a deterritorialized body which operates in a multiplicity of scales, from the molecular to the planetary, and which might be defined as a transcorporeal material network traveling inside and outside bodies, composed of feedback cycles and metabolic patterns that are distributed in scalar ways across bodies in space. For this reflection, I departed from the use of sound as an investigative tool to analyze the industrial and infrastructural rhythms imposed on matter. This tool allows me not only to sense the environment and engage with communities, but also to start conversations about ecological politics and relations of dispossession already taking place throughout the riverine spaces that I research. In The Invention of Rivers, Dilip de Cunha revises our concept of river, asking how we see it and frame it territorially and infrastructurally, questioning what is the extent of its course. He asks, quote, what would it mean for designers to take responsibility for the existence of a river? End of quote. Dilip de Cunha questions the naturalization of infrastructure and the role of design in spatial practices in reinscribing forms of partition in natural systems. He calls for new kinds of river literacies and guides us through the rethinking the role and mutations of the coastline, the riverbank, and the water's edge at a time when the sea level rise and resource management necessitate the construction of levees and land retiring schemes. He states that, quote, there is no such thing as dryness. There is only wetness in various degrees, end of quote. Challenging us to reflect how we can anchor our imagination of the water cycle at other phases of this element's journey, and what would this reimagination of the river as a man-made infrastructure bring? So where does the river start and end? Does it only live outside bodies? Who manages the right to flow? Proposing a resilient cohabitation in the hydrocommons, activist Vandana Shiva published in 1994 Water Wars, which focus on the political frictions and impacts of settler colonial legacies of infrastructural implementations in India. Shiva's testimony deconstructs the Eurocentric and developmental narratives that perpetuate economies of subalternization, addressing a much-needed revision of the politics of the common infrastructures. She introduces her views on water as a sacred right to be shared and distributed by all planetary inhabitants, addressing the history of anti-proprietary management of water and how it has been developed in different locations in India based on core values such as sharing and conservation that preceded the intervention of British legal instruments. Shiva takes us on a scalar reading of the politics of irrigation through times, accusing sovereign states of perpetuating forms of bodily subjugation and necropolitics when they allow for the distribution of toxicity and the institution of the right to pollute. These different perceptions and political mobilizations of water systems have much to do with the ontological conceptualizations of water for different cultures, which in the West has led to the creation of virtual water markets and the construction of megadam projects in opposition to more communal modes of aquatic use and coexistence. So this is an actual illustration map of the Mississippi River and its course a long time. So the Mississippi, like many rivers, changes course. And these are some of its many courses along history. So we can feel its dynamic existence. So the Mississippi River passes through 31 American states and has many tributaries, defining itself as a living regulatory entity influenced by the coastal management plans that modulate its containment and flow, having built 16,000 kilometers of canals along its course to support the oil industry. The Mississippi is one of the most important shipping rivers in the world. Crude oil, natural gas, coal, steel, soybeans, maize, chemical fertilizers, animal feed, wheat, and sugar are a few of the major products traded along the river. And the Mississippi Delta corresponds to 8% of total U.S. gas reserves, processing 3.3 million barrels of crude oil per day, and is the third largest coal exporting port in the world. The 16,000 kilometers of built canals create water diversions to control the river's will to change course and create shipping lanes. However, as the water is filled with nitrogen and phosphate from the intensive agriculture, it destroys the roots of the vegetation of the marshlands, allowing storms to rush through them easily and the delta to disappear with the corroding lands exposed to high salinity. The area which I visited, extending from Baton Rouge down to New Orleans, used to be referred to as plantation country, with 400 plantations over from Plaquemines Island down to the delta that have now been replaced by oil refineries. These days, the petrochemical corridor is known as Cancer Alley or Death Alley and has extremely high cancer rates. In the Cancer Alley, quote, "The level of toxicity increases with the darkness of the skin," says local activist singer Wendy Moore O'Neill. Here, forms of labor and land dispossession have been taking place over the centuries as water is militarized and the land occupied by international corporations that expropriate local communities, erasing memorials and colonizing healthy bodies as the petrochemical industries and carceral institutions replace previous plantations. Toxicity operates in a particular speed that Rob Nixon characterized as slow violence, a marked inattention to endure forms of ecosystemic and social vulnerability that have been set in place by corrosive modes of capitalist extraction, disempowerment, and displacement. Brian Holmes describes rivers, quote, "not as a linear continuum stretching from source to sea, but instead as a fluctuating aquatic terrestrial transition zone, a moving littoral offering the image of a dynamic process that does not disrupt, but rather defines the river," end of quote. What if this moving littoral and all the processes that it entails travels within and outside bodies? This area of the Mississippi is close to where the first U.S. climate refugees are being evacuated from. Here, the hydrocycle is the pacemaker of the city of New Orleans and its surroundings, says architect Aaron Chung, as he explained to me that 78 drainage pumping stations work 24/7 to prevent the soil of New Orleans to sink through subsidence. The seasonal pulse of water is replaced by its industrial version. The impacts of water restoration projects get criticized permanently as they partake in zoning practices, including some and excluding others, creating conflicts in communities with its perpetual imaginary of permanent techno-fixing and mastery of man over nature. Brian Holmes criticizes the Army Corps Mississippi River and Tributary Project system of emergency floodways that are designed as territorial diversions to temporarily relieve the pressure of rapidly rising river stages, as he says that the river diversion and containment project is in sync with the rhythm of the extractive project of intensive agriculture and oil industry, which has defined the ecology of the floodplains to the point of favoring corn, soybeans, cotton, and rice over any other life form. The result, complete with copious amounts of diesel fuel and synthetic nitrogen, says Holmes, is one of the major components of global climate change. A completely industrialized agricultural system based on fossil fuel inputs, oriented toward foreign markets and exported to the rest of the world as a developmental model. Sorry. The seasonal pulse of river in flooding, which plays a vital role in planetary metabolism, is now determined by the fossil industry and agricultural lobbies, who through the purchase of flowage rights since the 1930s, determine what can get flooded, deciding on what may be conceived as more valuable. So I traveled along the petrochemical corridor in November last year. It's more or less 200 kilometers, and we paddle on these canoes. We're like 15 people, so this is like the smallest boat that you, and most stable that you can have for the Mississippi without an engine. I went with the Haus der Kultur in der Welt and some students from Minnesota. Different scientists and researchers joined along the travel, so there were different stretches. I did the last one. And we would, you know, paddle down the Mississippi on the side lane because in the middle lane, you know, the stream of the river is really, really strong and there's cargo containers, barges, there's a lot of shipping. And during this trip, you know, different people were like collecting soil samples and doing research around river literacy. There would be fill stations in between each stretch of the path. And we would meet scientists, local activists, and have an exchange. And there was a workshop in New Orleans in the end. And as, you know, much of the Mississippi is made through the sediments that run along its course, and the sediments themselves are the only thing which is not private property. So we could only sleep and camp on small islands or sandbanks around the river. All the rest was, you know, refineries and, you know, heavily militarized. There were, you know, sometimes helicopters on top of us, and it was, you know, kind of idyllic but very kind of pressured space. So during this trip, I made hydrophone recordings using sound as a tool to sense the environment, which I playbacked to communities and tried to use as a pedagogic tool and as a trigger to start collective debates about environmental politics, notions of spectral dispossession, and perceptions of the bodily. These are some of our maps in the morning. We used to, you know, have a sense of where we go and read this online amazing archive called River Gator. So it's a mile-by-mile Mississippi journal online that people can use if they travel. And it not only describes where you can stop and gives you some tips, but also everything that the refineries produce and all the derivatives of oil. And, you know, it talks to you about the extreme levels of toxicity. So it's an amazing resource, this River Gator, if anybody's interested. And the river runs like a snake, so it's a very beautiful drawing, I think. So with my hydrophone, I mostly recorded boat engine noise and dredging activities. And with my Zoom recorder, I did ambient recordings of its surroundings, such as the one that you heard on your arrival and you hear afterwards with the insects, which includes factory noise and some animal sounds. They're cicadas. So by using sound, I was interested in sensing the continuity between bodies and the environment, trying to think about the infrastructural body as a vibrational architecture that trespasses matter while looking at the effects of extractive petrochemical industries across different scales and speeds. I was trying to find a sonic residue of toxicity. The multiple temporalities of toxicity challenge our capacity for representation and effectiveness of visual tools when it comes to registering slow violence. Something that is still unnoticed may be already provoking change on a minute molecular scale. I use sound as a tool to investigate the power relations that are already taking place but not yet imprinted in the geological stratum. I've been searching for a rhythmic imprint of infrastructure on matter, trying to speculate how living systems react and adapt to industrialization, asking, along Twin Cities sound artist Monica Haller, what forms of imaginative listening can we deploy to find traces of what is already taking place, but is still invisible at sight? So what happens when the sound spectrum crosses matter? And what is the infrastructural body, if not composite of molecular and vibrational architectures that extend across species and entities, across multiple temporal, spatial-temporal scales, like Gabriel Hash describes through her concept of interscalar vehicle when speaking of transtemporal aspect of radioactivity? Can we read the river as a living geological strata and our almost liquid bodies as part of the river system, seeing a continuum between bodies and the environment? Recently acknowledged by Western medicine as a new organ, the interstitium, also known as fascial system lying beneath our skin and enveloping all organs and body parts may be understood as an endocrine organ, a sensory system, and metabolic regulator. This connective tissue, which has long been studied by Chinese medicine as a site of intervention, is composed both of liquids and solid interchanging parts, and is responsible for, quote, bioelectrical cellular and tissue plasticity responses, as well as their interactions with other tissues, may be key also to understanding how pathological changes in one part of the body may cause a cascade of remote effects in seemingly unrelated areas of organ systems. Similarly, fish have whole-body sensory systems that interpret vibration. Sensing sound through the mixed support of their swim bladder and lateral lines, a series of receptors structured along the body enabling detection of hydrodynamic signals such as water motion, registering it as pulsating waves. So can we think of the river and the body as an whole auditory system, endocrinological and also sensing system? So this is one of few diagrams that I've been doing to find my way out and trying to connect noise and toxicity in the Mississippi, because I was having conversations with local activists and they said that, you know, most people were really concerned with toxicity. And I was really amazed that in a place that has 24/7 exposure to really high noise baselines, that this wasn't being observed. And actually, there's no acoustic ecology studies being done in the area. So to tell you a little bit, very fast. So sound and air pollution and electromagnetism around the riverbeds of the Mississippi are sensed through the body's fascia, the limbic system, respiratory system, the primovascular system, that is the meridian system, blood and nervous systems. So reactions and forms of register in our body fluids and vital energy of qi. This results in enzymatic, endocrinological, metabolic, and immune responses that alter the capacity of DNA storage, regulating body fluids, living cells, and the electrical conductivity in our bodies. And all of this is connected to how we physically sense the environment and register degrees of trauma. One can ask, how much of this is taken into consideration by industrial developers or when environmental impact assessment studies is being done? What are the politics of sensing that we want to promote? And how is conductivity regulated? I've been reflecting on what is a sensor, how it expands outside and inside one's body, be it in an embodied or extended form, and what kinds of synesthetic boundaries and sensing hierarchies are we aware in both human and other than human sensorial systems? What if embodiment was told through the perspective of materials or water itself? Can the river be a sensor? How do we articulate embodiment and our connection or disconnection from the environment? And from what angle? Analyzing how extractive infrastructures create forms of dispossession, sociologist Macarena Gomez-Barres, in her book The Extractive Zone, speaks of the importance to read the world by giving attention to submerged perspectives, asking us to think from interstitial spaces and question how knowledge is produced. What does it mean to sense or listen from below? Challenging how we perceive the world, Gomez-Barres speaks about positionality from the murky space where one, quote, blends the way that each of us perceives ourselves with and how we perceive the natural world, end of quote. She theorizes how the submerged perspectives that have hierarchically been instituted as such by the verticality of the techno-scientific perspective may be given other kinds of value. Think, for example, of satellite imagery and mapping practices disclosing remote sites in the Amazon or the deep sea. Practices of mapping criticized by Nicholas Mirzoev as a form of state and corporation-led digital colonialism. These views from below that Macarena refers to which I would add the domain of the molecular, non-human, and the sonic, may be mobilized as counter-aesthetic strategies to bring to light different political positions and ontological inhabitations of the world. Thinking through scales and sonic textures might help us to reflect what are the imposed limits of the sensing body and develop more accurate ecological politics. These practices of listening and attunement to other than human realities counter the exclusionary rhythms of the industrial domain. So another location right next to where we stand has led me to think through the relations of noise, toxicity, and infrastructure around aquatic infrastructures. That is the Tejo River estuary, as you can recognize by the image. The natural reserve of the Tagus estuary, whose 14,500 hectares encircle the largest marshland in the country, itself some 34,000 hectares wide. This marsh is the largest in Western Europe and is home to 100,000 migrating birds that come here in the winter, including flamingos, ducks, and shorebirds that move between the Arctic and Africa, South Africa, which are part of the large community of 200,000 birds that live here. Like the Mississippi Delta, the Tejo River estuary is part of a network of wetlands that are crucial to protect at the moment. These wetlands have an important metabolic role in carbon sequestration and substance filtering due to the accumulation of nutrients and sediments that, along the consistency of the tide, regulate levels of water toxicity, absorbing and fixing heavy metals in their sludge, while filtering other nutrients through activities of resident microorganisms. Wetlands are protected by the Ramsar Convention of 71, signed in Iran, which in 2007 mapped 1,280 million hectares of wetlands on the planet, corresponding to 9% of the Earth's surface. Why are wetlands so important? Because they are responsible for sequestering some 35% of global terrestrial carbon, with a potential to capture and store more than 200 metric tons of blue carbon every year. We call it blue carbon because it's in this intertidal zone. And on wetlands, carbon sequestration takes place at a speed about 30 to 50 times faster than forests. And these ecosystems store 50 to 90% of carbon in the soil, so along the shorelines, where it can remain for thousands of years if undisturbed. However, when coastal swamps are drained or degraded, think, for example, of the Sado River, the stored carbon can reoxidize, accelerating its release into the atmosphere, which sometimes corresponds to the emission of centuries' worth of stored carbon in just a few decades. That's why dredging is an activity that should not be promoted so much. At the present, it is estimated that 65% of the planet's wetlands are degraded or damaged, making it increasingly urgent that we pay attention to wetland conservation and restoration projects. From it also depend numerous forms of economy, from ecotourism to clam picking, which in the Tejo estuary is mostly done by migrant workers who catch 30 million euros worth of mollusks every year. So it's a really big economy. But the Tejo marshland in its natural reserve is being threatened by toxicity in the water. As we know, the river comes from Spain, which has 14 dams. We have two dams, so the regulation of organic matter and pollution is done by the right to flow that, you know, these dams control. And also we have the famous case of Celtejo, which is polluting the river with its toxic foams due to cellulose processing, and is connected, of course, with the eucalyptus-intensive agriculture. And all of this is somehow ending up right where we are, right here. But also, as you see here, this is the site of the new airport of Montijo that is being planned, which is being contested by activists, scientists, and different people, also in the bird conservation community, also international organizations, because not only the site in Montijo where they want to make the airport is actually one of the places in the river estuary where the waters will rise and it will be sunk really, really quickly. But also it's exposed as it's along a fracture line where earthquakes can take place, so it's also exposed to tsunamis. Something that concerns these associations is, of course, the dangers of collision with the 200,000 birds that live in the natural reserve. We have to think that the natural reserve, for example, only covers, I think, 10 meters below the waterline and 11 above. But if you think of birds, do you think they see juridical, borders? Of course not. So, of course, there's a lot of contested things around these airports. On my concern, I'm also looking at, how the potential noise effects and all the sub-bass that is being produced will also alter the migratory patterns of these communities. And this is also an airport that, it's, on my view, unnecessarily being planned, but it will expand the income of tourists and passengers in Lisbon up to 50 million per year. And we were, I think, on 20-something just recently. So it's really, expected a huge increase. Other things in the estuary that concern me are, of course, the cruise terminal that is not so well legislated. I don't know if you know, but we are one of the cities in Europe that has most cruises parked. And when they park, they don't turn their engines off. So they're basically always producing a lot of toxic emissions, which are, have much more density in terms of fuels than cars in the city, but also continuous emissions of noise and water. And these are a few things that we should think along the lines of the decarbonization plan of the country. So the riverine infrastructure around Lisbon has other plan changes, such as the floating city in Casilhas that is being planned, which will be built along the development of the River South Bay. But are also some good news in what concerns sound politics in the river and the surrounding Portuguese coast. Biologists started the monitorization of ferry noise in the estuary, looking at the overlap between ferry emissions and the reproductive rhythms of various endemic fish species, such as charroque or curvina legitima, having this species conservation as an end goal. With CIANA NGO, that I sometimes collaborate, they work on marine policy, we started a conversation about ocean noise, debating it alongside shipping issues and the decarbonization of Portuguese harbors, and are thinking how this issue could be presented, the issue of noise, as an intersectional problem throughout campaigns. Also, the Marine Hydrographic Institute is developing the European project JONES for ocean noise monitorization, producing the first coastal sound maps, which study the impacts of acoustic pollution, ship silencing methods, noise emitted by seismic reflection on oil and gas prospection, the impacts of offshore wind turbines, and the use of sound in aquaculture, among other issues. So I will be an observer in Jonas project with the Instituto Hidrográfico. In my research, I will go with the Navy to set the first hydrophone arrays. There is a series of microphones in the water. They will spread it along the Portuguese coast. And I will be studying the collective process of sound mapping and how it's being developed as a transdisciplinary space of debate, which merges fields of study and kickstarts conversations about ocean conservation and data governance. As we know, sound travels 4 times faster on water, depending on the depth, the temperature, and the salinity, and recognizes no nation-state borders, exclusive economic zones, or juridical regimes. On water, we can indeed listen quickly to sounds emitted across long distances. And as such, sound has been used for military purposes ever since the development of sonars, an activity which was heightened during the Cold War. Despite the high sonic baseline of our oceans, sound is also used for monitorization of species in underwater volcanoes, as well as seabed mapping, and has been a great aid to deep sea ecologists who do not always have the technological means to explore the ocean's depth. Water conductivity has made sound the ideal medium to sense unknown abyssal ecosystems requiring new practices of listening, much like cosmologists have developed when studying the cosmic background radiation. Epilogue. So I'm coming to an end. Artist Stacey Ho asked, quote, "Does water remember everything it circulated through, all the materials it passed by? What about our bodily fluids? End of quote. If water is a form of transgenerational chi, where vibrational architectures travel, what kind of rhythmic responsibility do we have towards it? I propose that we develop practices of listening and attunement that engage in debates about infrastructural politics and ecosystem conservation, while stimulating forms of knowledge production that widen the perceptive and juridical spectrum. The biopolitical impact of conductivity is amplified in the aquatic realm due to forms of circulatory energy, identifying the power relations that are already taking place, but perhaps invisible and noticed interscalar, or acting at different speeds and parts of the spectrum is crucial. Investigating river systems and intertidal spaces as whole auditory systems, one can reflect about the politics of rhythm and strategies for conservation, while accounting for the different temporalities of toxicity, river pulses, and corporeal configurations. Finding practices that challenge forms of sensorial and environmental dispossession might propose modes of restorative listening and ecological justice that give space to other than human entities, whose sensorial systems we still know very little about. Only from this intersubjective space that is open to listen beyond the oppressive threshold of industrialization and speciesism can stimulate our ecological responsibility towards other sensing systems and begin to channel planetary chi. Thank you. I know this was a lot, but I'm really happy to engage in any questions and feedback. I know some people are doing research in the Teju, and maybe some people are working on conservation. So, yeah, don't feel shy. If anybody also travels through the Mississippi, I'm open to hear your story about this landscape.
Hi, just a curiosity, if you would like to expand on it. Curious how you foresee the European project of sonification of the Portuguese coast in relation to data governance and the future of that. I guess it's a very open comment question, but maybe that will also help other questions come to the fore.
That's a UN level kind of question, which I don't have information yet. What can I say? We've been having these conversations, Mariana, that every time I go to this kind of blue economy conferences, they're always about water and data, and you get confused what's what. So it's very interesting to see how minds are working into making some kind of data patchwork of the whole ocean, and how ideas of data governments are so confusing. You know, there are a bunch of treatises being signed for cooperation and for, you know, sharing resources. But Jessica Lehmann, for example, is a really interesting researcher working on data politics in the ocean, which is really referring to, you know, the blind spots and in the holes in these processes. In terms of genres, the joint network for sound mapping around mostly Western Europe, so that's with Ireland, France, and so on. It's a recent project that has been a bit delayed, of course, because of COVID time. But it's already, you know, on the spot as an interesting initiative, because they're trying to adapt, well, maybe this is too nerdy, the descriptor 11 of the production of energy on water, which is launched by the European Union. So there's an idea that state members have to act and start producing their sound maps. So there will be, you know, a cooperation, I think, between 7 countries for this project. I don't know the particularities how data is being shared there, but I have curiosity in thinking how they will analyze these sound maps if the sonic baseline is already so industrialized. Maybe on COVID times we actually had a data gap here that could have been interesting to record. But at the moment they propose to record 2 years and then make comparisons. But I think it's already really difficult to work from that. I don't know if I answered, but soon I'll have more. Uriel, yeah.
Thank you. That was really interesting and inspiring. And I have a very different question. I was quite intrigued with the metaphor or the method of using qi as a mapping device. And I think it's really interesting because it's obviously a kind of stream or flow that maps an energy which is not visible. And obviously sound is not visible either. And you talked about transgenerational qi, and I just wonder how far this can go in terms of like the qi of the planet and the qi of the body. And I just thought it would be interesting to hear a little bit more about that.
I wish I had studied Chinese medicine, which I haven't yet. So, anybody studied Chinese medicine here? Okay. So I'll just make up an answer. I was having this conversation with artist Stacey Ho. She's based in Canada, I think Montreal. And on the Denise Ferreira da Silva's Sensing Salon this January, we had a whole day on water. And she was mostly talking about virtual water markets and so on. But then I started thinking of this transgenerational qi as something, you know, that passes through your body and is filtered through your kidneys, but it also filters through these aquatic infrastructures in the planet. So it's something that if you think along the Navajo seven generation principle, you know, you have a lot of information being registered here and responsibility and what is filtered and where it goes and what it passes through. I should study some more of this, you know. For me, it feels like a kind of an ethical task to think along these lines. And she sometimes problematizes ideas of partition, no? Because it goes through different bodies. That stimulates my thought, I think. Yeah. Jean.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. I have a very pragmatic question. I'm not very informed in terms of geoengineering, but I do have a geoengineering question. This is the only book I've read is like that After Geoengineering book by Holly Jean Buck, but that's about it. And then I've also just listened to a podcast about the Mississippi Delta and the issue around the Army Corps of Engineers and the preparation for increased hurricanes and sea level rise, and that and there being a sort of like a balance that one needs to strike in terms of like the economy with fish, like the fishing economy, farming, the increased salinity because of like the way that the barriers are being built, but then also like the need for engineering a way to sort of protect that part, that just the delta itself from hurricanes and sea level rise. And I guess my question there is there any such thing as good geoengineering?
I hope so. Because we're certainly coming to the era of geoengineering, so I hope there's some good one. I think the problem there is the politics of scale. And from some things I read on geoengineering, many decisions are taken, of course, by guys on suits on small offices talking to guys on suits. We actually have no, you know, contact with communities that are exposed. And also geoengineering has this kind of human mastery over nature problem where you think, oh yeah, A plus B equal expected results. And actually, we're talking about open systems, so we can never, you know the results. Of course, we need coastal restoration projects. But here in the Mississippi and in the image that I showed, you come from the U.S., the idea of containing the river flux has to do with, you know, settler colonialism and the desire of, you know, very specific forms of economy. So should these economies change space? Maybe. Some refineries have left the Delta because of waters rising, but I'm not sure how much economy is willing to to change its own desires over the possibility of some kind of geoengineering. Yeah. I don't know how to answer that question, but I think it's a good one.
Well, first of all, thank you. It was very, very interesting. And my question relates to the recordings that you made. Mm-hmm. And first of all, where can we, or are they available, or when will they be available? And second is, how do you process that kind of data? Like, I imagine it's hours and hours of just sound. And third is, how does, well, I find that like field recordings can have a really spiritual, they can connect spiritually in a very deep way. Is that something you accidentally experienced, or, you know, it was on purpose that you went on that path?
Thank you for your question. You can listen to some, not many, field recordings on SoundCloud. I'm a little shy with that. It's a really recent SoundCloud. But there are a couple of audios there. And we just had an exhibition in Berlin called The Current, where the people that did the river journey showed their research and process. And it will go to a couple of places in the US. Maybe I'll try to bring it here if there is a desire for that. It's a really interesting group of people. And everybody was using different media to think through the river. How do I process? So I'm not an acoustician, so I don't do the typical acoustic ecology, like tons of raw data that is never heard and that is processed by computers. That's a different methodology. Some people are doing that in the Delta and looking at how whale migratory patterns are being intersected by all industry. What I do is I use sound as a more kind of ethnographic tool. So I would go record since mostly like a sound artist, you know, not as an acoustician. So I don't like process data. I play things over and over and think through them. And then, you know, sometimes run workshops or play them for a group of people and record their reactions. And we have conversations about, you know, conservation. We did that along the journey. And also play it back to some activists and try to have a conversation like, you know, do you think there is interest in thinking about this? And what do you feel like listening to this sound? And if you consider the Mississippi through this dimension? A little bit like that is how I use it. So there is no idea of accuracy. It's more how to reflect after you just kind of took a field note. It's more like a field note. On the spiritual answer, I'm not sure what to answer, but I really enjoy the collective listening experience as a space, a shared space. I think it's a really great form of slow activism. Yeah. We can talk more about it later. I'd like to hear your take on it. Is everybody freezing cold? Or any more questions? Or we call it a day? Good.